Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Ruth Morgan about her book titled Climate Change and International History, Negotiating Science, Global Change and Environmental Justice, just published in 2024 from Bloomsbury. This is a really interesting book, I found, and also a really important book because it examines how climate change has been debated, discussed, configured in the international arena all the way back from the 1950s, very much up until today. And given how much climate change is still part of international debates, I think this is a pretty important bit of history to be aware of. So, Ruth, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Miranda.
Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. That's a very good place to start, as you say. I'm approaching this book as an environmental historian and a historian of science, so perhaps not necessarily the first kind of expertise you might think of when tackling these issues, especially from this position of international history. I've previously worked on histories of climate and water, mainly in the Australian context and also in a comparative sense, often putting the Australian experience into connection and comparison, say, with the American West or parts of the British Empire. And my first book was on how settler Australians have understood and adapted to the particular climate conditions of the southern half of the continent, and then how a changing climate with reduced rainfall has influenced, I suppose, the ways that settler Australians in particular have used resources and tried to establish a particular way of life. So in some ways, I sort of see this book that I'm discussing with you today as something of an extension or an offshoot of that work to understand how that local story, or it was felt local to me, fits into this much bigger international story. And I've also worked on the recent IPCC sixth assessment report in Working Group 2. So I had some broad familiarity with the institutions of governing climate change. And of course, I'm aware of the frustrations of many about the pace of climate action and how that is perceived often to be too slow in light of the accelerating changes that we're seeing. So I felt that it was important for us to have a well, for myself, I guess, quite selfishly, to try to understand how climate change and climate more generally has come to be understood in the way that we do now, that has become this sort of subject of international governance, and that it's not just a handful of countries that have a role in its government. It's all countries. And that makes for, I suppose, the challenges, I think, that we've faced. But it's also quite important, I think, to explore what kind of dynamics come through with that particular arrangement. And it's important, I think, to recognise how current understandings of climate change weren't inevitable. They are a particular outcome of a whole series of historical events, I suppose. And I'm curious to, I suppose, flesh out the implications of that history.
What a great kind of introduction, I think, to the book. So many things there that we're going to talk more about. So thank you for starting us off with that. I'd like to kind of pick up that last point first, the idea that it's not inevitable that we ended up where we are now, because in fact, if we go back to the sort of beginning chronologically of the period you cover, you actually talk about there was quite a bit of optimism in terms of global coordination and the weather right after World War II, which definitely I read going, global optimism about the weather? Okay, that sounds different from today. So can you tell us what was going on at this point and sort of help us understand kind of when and how and with what impact this initial positive feeling starts to fade?
Yes, I was really struck by the contrast as well, and the great optimism that followed the Second World War. And when we know that obviously, the Second World War ended with such devastation when we're thinking about the effects of the atomic bombs on Japan. And yet at the same time, there is a collection of very internationally minded scientists and policymakers and intellectuals, I suppose, who are really keen to see what is emerging as one world thinking, to see that actually being realised as a way really to avoid further devastation, to avoid further catastrophe. They wanted international institutions, obviously the United Nations is one product of this way of thinking, but they felt very strongly that these kinds of global institutions would be a way to avoid such devastation unfolding again. So to really bring about this kind of one worldism beyond its sort of a vision or an imaginary, it was a real project. And I've mentioned the United Nations, but the agencies that came out of this this moment included the World Meteorological Organization, which is a subset of the United Nations. And there was a sense that, well, meteorology naturally lent itself to this kind of outlook because, of course, the atmosphere doesn't respect geopolitical borders. And that was something that had become very clear during the war as well, that that fighting the war required a very strong knowledge of atmospheric changes, about meteorological conditions. So in some ways, the war had primed scientists and governments to think about how meteorology could be better coordinated, could be a shared and unified effort. So this is where some of that optimism is coming from. There's also what I found surprising was an optimism emerging specifically from the atomic bombs, that in fact, putting aside obviously the enormous human impact, that this could herald a means of weather control. And there was great hope there that humans could finally overcome this, I suppose, limit on their development. I mean, this was a very hopeful way of thinking. But with a greater recognition of what was at stake as rivalries started to emerge after the end of the war and Cold War tensions started to develop, that atomic weapons and the science and the knowledge behind that was actually going to really define the coming era and be a source of tension rather than the means of bringing humanity together. Would actually be part of keeping that fierce rivalry and tension alive. So more countries beyond the United States started to develop their own testing regimes, that's when we start to see that kind of fading optimism, that instead having the power of weather control might actually fall into the wrong hands. And that really becomes something that influences the way that the ways that scientists and their governments begin to think about what's at stake when they are investigating the weather.
Hmm. The way you tell it, it sounds like a very sort of straightforward transition. But I think that's more to do with your ability to make all this make sense, because that really is quite a big shift. And I think also useful for that reminder that kind of, in some senses, we might think about climate politics as being sort of its own sphere of debate. And yet, no, the Cold War is a huge part of this, right? It's not something we can just kind of magically separate out.
Absolutely. I think this is the one of the aspects that I suppose I kept coming back to with almost a degree of frustration of how so often I think when we do talk about climate politics, it's presented as somehow separate from everything else, as though it is a distinct form of environmental change that is somehow separated from energy systems, from geopolitics, from questions of development. And yet, writing this history, I kept finding it had to keep growing to encapsulate the roots of, in fact, all the processes that are feeding into this current moment that we're experiencing. So that rather than being a story strictly of, shall we say, scientific discovery and political cooperation, albeit with, of course, many hiccups along the way, it's actually, I realized it was a story about development, about the Cold War, about competition, about different visions of the future and how, I suppose, countries sought to establish the post-war order and then how that was remade again at the end of the Cold War.
Hmm. I want to add another aspect to these political discussions, given what you've just helpfully kind of made sure that we link throughout this. I want to add in another piece of science, if we can, to these debates, you know, just to make it more complicated. You've been talking so far about the weather, right? And we've got the idea of nuclear weapons, of the Cold War. When and how and why does carbon dioxide come into these discussions, both on the sort of, quote, pure science side, but also in terms of these international political debates?
This is a funny question, I think, because, again, when we look at, I suppose, perhaps timelines of our understandings of the climate and climate change, we become quickly aware that the link scientifically or physically, I should say, between rising levels of carbon dioxide and rising global temperatures had actually been theorized in the mid-19th century, both in the United States and in Great Britain. And that can lead people to assume, well, we've known about this problem for well over 100 years and we've done nothing about it. But what's important to recognize is that that was just one of many theories, and in fact, one that wasn't necessarily mainstream until quite late in the piece, really, not until after the Second World War. And that's quite surprising, I think. And what's also important to recognize is that when there was subsequent iterations of the connection between carbon dioxide and a warming climate at the turn of the 20th century, this was indeed welcomed by scientists who were working in Northern Europe, because they thought, well, it's awfully cold here. We have problems of not being able to grow enough crops because of the climate conditions. They were welcoming these warmer conditions and they hoped that burning coal would warm the climate for them. So they were in fact, quite optimistic about the results of this theory. But again, at this stage, it was not the mainstream, and there were all sorts of other ideas about what might be affecting the climate patterns they're observing. And they were observing changes in sea ice and changes in climate conditions, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere. And they were trying to, during the 1930s, 40s and 50s, trying to work out, well, what was the cause of those changes? And when there is again another suggestion that, well, perhaps carbon dioxide and as a result of industrialization might have something to do with these changes, they were dismissed. They were not accepted as the cause. So it's not really until the 50s and 60s, partly as a result of nuclear tests, partly as a result of the measurement of changing levels of carbon dioxide through international scientific cooperation, they start to acknowledge that, in fact, the levels of carbon dioxide are increasing, and there is something to this theory that actually this could well warm the planet. So as much as we've known perhaps the theory at a sort of very theoretical sense, I guess, it's not really until we're right into the thick of the Cold War that, and becoming concerned about air pollution at more at local scales, that the prospect of a human impact on the climate is actually begun to be recognised and understood.
Hmm. I definitely was surprised to read that section, because it's so kind of embedded now to think about carbon dioxide that it was really interesting to kind of see that wasn't necessarily what I had thought, and kind of how it did become such a key part of the discourse. So in this kind of vein, I suppose, of setting the terms of the debate and coming up with, I think, a lot of the framing we still very much have, adding on to what you've told us about climate change, carbon dioxide, can you talk us through Stockholm 1972?
Absolutely. This is a kind of foundational moment in international environmental governance, for want of a better term. We have a concern at the highest level, at the international level, for states to come together to discuss shared environmental problems. And very quickly, the meeting kind of descended into the struggles that continued to dominate international environmental politics well into the 90s, if not longer. And these were issues that quite understandably centered on questions of development and the use of resources. And the framing of these international environmental issues was very quickly perceived by the major governments of what was the developing world, the global south, if you like. They approached these issues that the developed countries, the industrialized countries, were presented with great suspicion, because countries like India, countries like China and Brazil perceived the agenda that was emerging as having grave consequences for the development of their own peoples. They were incredibly concerned with what it would mean for them if they were to have limits on the resources that they could exploit or extract within their own borders. So the environmental politics that the Global North was presenting at the time was seen as a real threat to their development. They saw this as a way for the North to halt their development, to basically stall the trajectory that these countries saw themselves on of uplifting their populations from poverty, as so their leaders put it. And they argued that, well, the North had created these problems, so why should they be putting any kind of barriers to the continued growth of the developing world? So it was very clear at Stockholm in 1972, that these discussions were not going to be straightforward, that they were going to be very much centered almost not on the environment per se, but on questions of development and how countries could manage their growth sustainably. I mean, we didn't have quite the sustainability discourse that emerges in the late 1980s at this point, but the seeds are being sown here. And it took some convincing for economists and thinkers to really explain how, in fact, development could potentially be pursued in ways that were sustainable, that weren't going to necessarily come at the cost of these countries' development. So it was definitely a struggle. And we saw, I've mentioned India, China and Brazil, these countries would continue to be at the forefront of the atmospheric politics that continued over the following decades. And the discussions that emerged in Stockholm really mapped out some of the framing, I guess, that we would continue to see, particularly around managing air pollution and who was responsible when air pollution drifted beyond a state's borders. So transboundary air pollution was very much a concern of this time. One of the sort of factors, I guess, that led to holding this conference in the first place had been Scandinavian concerns about acid rain coming from Germany and from the United Kingdom. So this was kind of the background. They weren't thinking climate change in the same way that we are thinking about it today. That was certainly on the agenda, but not of priority. And among the demands that the developing world made at the conference was that, well, if we are to limit our pollution or to change our course of development, then we need financial support to do so, and we need the transfer of technical skills and expertise to accelerate this process. So this becomes understood in terms of the concept of additionality, that in addition to existing aid, further support would be necessary to ensure that they could meet these goals. But I think what's also interesting about Stockholm is that it brings together what we would today describe as civil society, which I think is a bit of an opaque term, because at this point in time, Stockholm attracted almost an unofficial conference, really, beyond the government delegations, whereby we saw representations from a whole range of representatives of different causes and interests. And one of the prominent movements that I was really, you know, struck by and interested in, and I follow it in the book, is the engagement of Indigenous peoples in the conference, and trying to navigate this United Nations framing, I suppose, and conference, and to the way that Indigenous leaders from North America and from Northern Europe started to see that there was an opportunity here to advance their own cause through concerns about the environment. So I think we see some key players and key strains, I guess, of the climate politics that we know today really emerging in the early 1970s.
Really interesting to hear kind of how many of those things are still very much part of the conversation, and many of those kind of dynamics as well, of sort of whose responsibility is it, and sort of some amount of dividing line between developing countries and more developed ones. Though I think quite helpfully, as we go further, you're going to complicate that for us so we don't kind of fall into false binaries. But I want to kind of talk about this idea of the different countries, because although so far we've moved from sort of the right after World War II to the 1970s, talking about changes in science, talking about changes in political debates, there's also at the same time been a massive change in who's at the table, right? The United Nations has hugely expanded over this period, and therefore many other international organizations have as well, if we're looking, for example, if we only look at decolonization, that's a big piece of it in and of itself. How did this expansion impact these kinds of debates? Can we go into that in a bit more detail?
Absolutely. I think this is another aspect that we don't quite appreciate from our current viewpoint, is the enormous changes that were underway in the decades after the end of the Second World War, with the demise of various empires and the rise of a number of new and independent states. And of course, this process was influenced by Cold War rivalries and the different kinds of ambitions and aspirations of these decolonizing countries, and their, I suppose, the ways in which they sought to develop. But what I found was interesting is, perhaps it might not be as surprising to other people, but certainly I was really interested to see how even institutions like the World Meteorological Organization, something that you would assume on the face of it was a rather politically bland or somewhat neutral body of scientific coordination, was also shaped by what was going on through these processes of decolonization. What was one of the early parts of the story here with the emergence of newly independent countries was that many of these new states didn't have the infrastructures and systems to continue meteorological coverage, to continue the instrumental record. And so the WMO, as it's often known, becomes a means of transferring technology, training, science to these newly developing countries, newly independent, I should say, to ensure that global infrastructure for coordinating meteorological information is sustained, is actually made possible. And this is part of this continuation in some ways of this post-war meteorological optimism, that over time, with enough investment, with enough training, with enough coordination, that the coverage of the Earth's landmass, if not the ocean, would be made possible through this organization. So it's quite remarkable to see this I suppose, flow-on effect of what happens when these countries gain independence, and that it's actually concerns about monitoring the weather and being part of these institutions that it becomes so important, and that the WMO becomes almost shaping their form of government, which is quite remarkable. And then over time, not surprisingly, of course, Cold War tensions start to infuse the various meetings and conferences that are held under the auspices of the WMO. And not surprisingly, again, tensions really boil over when it comes to discussing, say, the impacts of the conflict in Indochina. And we see, of course, the tensions and the rivalries around the Soviet bloc and the United States play out at these conferences that are held, and accusations that, of course, the United States does not want aired in these sorts of forums. But, of course, these become opportunities for countries to air those grievances. And you see, as I quote in the book, a Cuban delegate linking the warfare and conflict in Southeast Asia to the impact on meteorology, and that this is, in fact, entirely contrary to the peaceful aims of the United Nations. So really using these opportunities to point out the hypocrisy and the contradictions that are going on, even in science, even in this moment of collaboration and coordination. This is it's not all it's cracked up to be. So there's a whole array of issues that are emerging as a result of decolonization. And one of the issues, I guess, that is sort of continues throughout the 1970s is a desire for a new international economic order. And that really starts to shape the debates well into the 1980s and beyond, a sense that the developing countries are no longer satisfied or prepared to tolerate the inequities of the international economic and political systems in which they understand themselves to be, well, certainly getting the raw end of the stick, and they want to see these inequities rebalanced, and this becomes an ongoing issue throughout the United Nations, and we continue to see that today.
We very much continue to see that today. So thank you for kind of going a bit further into that aspect, the sort of who's at the table and what are the debates, and especially I think that link to the global economic system, again going back to the point we've made that climate things are not in isolation.
That's right.
These debates are very much linked. Can we continue our trend, please, of complicating the story? Can we add in forests? When, how, with what impact do they get added to these discussions?
That's right. We do, I suppose, forget sometimes that, I mean, I suppose when we talk about climate change, we often see forests as a way to slow down climate change, to perhaps even fix the problem entirely, because as we know, trees are very important to the global carbon cycle, and they can absorb carbon dioxide, and we understandably are very concerned about deforestation and what that would mean, not only for the biodiversity of those places, but what it would mean from the perspective of greenhouse gas emissions and mitigation. But if we look back in time, in fact, forests and climates have a long and interesting relationship. Certainly, well, I won't go way back, but even during the colonial period of the 1800s and perhaps even earlier, an awareness of the local impacts of deforestation on local conditions, on stream flow, on desertification, on soils. So a real awareness that forests did have an important role to play and that they ought to be conserved. Now, I've mentioned acid rain and the concerns around transboundary air pollution and the impact of that problem on forests in Northern Europe as being a contributing issue to the urgency and interest in holding the 1972 Stockholm Conference. But scientifically, what's going on in the background is an awareness that, well, forests are part of the natural carbon cycle. This is something that's only being mapped out really in the 1940s and 1950s. And by the late 1970s, there becomes a real concern that deforestation is an additional source of carbon dioxide, that they weren't absorbing the carbon dioxide as scientists had hoped, but rather they were being, as they were being cut down, they were adding to the atmospheric accumulation of carbon dioxide. So becoming a real problem. And this is emerging, interestingly, and perhaps not coincidentally, at the same time as growing concern about the world's tropical forests. This is when we start to see a lot of concern, not only about industrialization and development projects happening in the Amazon, often funded by the World Bank and European countries, but also about the indigenous peoples that live in those forests and the impacts of these enormous projects on their lifeways and livelihoods. So this is an interesting intersection of concern about deforestation for the impacts at that local level from something of a humanitarian level, but also what it meant for the planet because of this understanding of a global carbon cycle. Now, this is where, as you might have already gathered, tensions and issues start to emerge, because while the forests might have a role to play in global or planetary processes, forests grow on land in particular nation states. So you start to see issues of sovereignty and development start to emerge. So very quickly, when these scientific concerns about deforestation emerge, mainly in the United States at first, it is perceived by developing countries like Brazil that this is some kind of intervention into their own affairs, into Brazil's affairs, and it ought to be not so much ignored, but actively rejected, that this was an incursion on their development. And this is an issue that we see play out throughout climate negotiations into the 1990s and beyond, because of the tension between atmospheric change at that planetary level and where these emissions and what's called a carbon sink are based, and they are within nation states. So it's absolutely a question of how governments can reconcile these tensions, these contradictions even, between the decisions that are happening within the nation state and the implications at that planetary level. So forests became a really interesting issue to explore, and how that changed over time. And another sort of aspect of this issue of forestry is that the concerns around deforestation in of the world's tropical forests was also complicated by the fact that in the old world per se, or the developed world, much of their forests had already been cleared. So again, developing countries like Brazil, like Indonesia, could turn around to the industrialized world and say, well, hang on, you've used your sources of you've used your forests, you can't tell us how to use ours, because of the implications for their development. So these issues become very much wrapped up in the kinds of approaches and solutions, for want of a better word, that are available to deal with this global problem.
Can we talk a bit about where these debates are happening? Or, I mean, I suppose where makes it sound like I mean kind of a building, and I don't quite mean literally a building. But I do kind of mean, I guess, the fora in which all of these discussions are being held. We briefly mentioned sort of the idea of kind of particular conferences being key. How did the UN and the IPCC become the sort of key institutions where all of this is being discussed and debated?
That's a really good point. And these are now very well established. Obviously, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is founded in 1988 as a joint initiative, really, of the World Meteorological Organization and the UN Environment Programme, which is a product, really, of the Stockholm Conference from 1972. And it's the first UN agency to be established in a developing country in Kenya. And that was not without contestation as well, of course. So we have the IPCC established to be basically a means for governments. It's a governmental body, that's important to remember, to negotiate the science of climate change, to clarify the scientific understandings, to work out degrees of uncertainty, to work out really what's going on, and to come to some kind of consensus, and that does become something of a challenge for this institution, not least because of governmental involvement. The other agencies that are involved in terms of the institutions of climate change are the UN General Assembly itself. And that perhaps is a surprising forum for us, but I think it it reflects the fact that climate change, as we've stated already, is not happening outside anything. It's not happening outside geopolitics or the political affairs that concern the United Nations more generally. So it's comes out of the United Nations General Assembly that indeed it's a matter of such grave importance that every country has a stake in this planetary phenomenon. And so out of this agreement in the late 1980s, we embark on a series of meetings to form what becomes the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in 1992. And so this is a body that, as I say, involves all the nations that are represented at the United Nations, plus observers as well. And so this is how, I suppose, we see the climate regime emerge at the end of the Cold War, where we have a scientific body, albeit one with government oversight, and a policy-focused body emerge, which also is constituted mostly by government representatives. But interestingly, there is space at the table for those that seek to advance or perhaps push forward climate action and the negotiation of a wider array of issues that can be seen through a climate lens. But there is also the opportunity for those that want to stall that action. And that is a curious element, I suppose, that is there from the outset, that we have both the champions, I suppose, of climate action and the laggards, or those that deliberately want to slow down and any policy making on these issues. And to see all of those groups represented is quite fascinating and peculiar, and I suppose really defines the rather, I suppose, strange and interesting negotiations that follow. Because once the Framework Convention is signed at the Rio conference in 1992, the parties of the Framework Convention begin to meet annually. These are the COPs that we now hear so much about when the delegations meet, and they're quite large get-togethers, and some are more momentous than others. But they start to meet every year from 1995, and they are the ones that then come up with defining arrangements, really, of governing climate change. The Kyoto Protocol, of course, the Paris Agreement. This emerges from the Framework Convention.
So, in fact, can we talk about the Kyoto Protocol, given sort of if we're in the mid-90s at this point, the combination of the sort of laggards and champions? The Kyoto Protocol is, I think, fair enough to say, is kind of one of the more famous elements of this new system being created. You talk about in the book that in many ways, both at the time and I think very much since then, it's considered sort of a watered down attempt or agreement, I suppose, on these issues. What were some of the key ways that it kind of ended up in this position? What does it have to do, for example, with the champions versus laggards setup that you just gave us?
Well, I think it's quite tragic in some ways that the Kyoto Protocol was somewhat hobbled from the outset. There were great ambitions for what this held, particularly I think in the mid-90s, before there was this recognition that in fact domestic politics would have a lot to contribute, I suppose, to the shaping of an international regime, that the participating governments had to go back to their home countries and make the case for the arrangements that were being agreed to. Now, with the Kyoto Protocol, we see these negotiations unfold from about 1995. This is 1995, we see the first conference of the parties in Berlin, and a recognition already that, oh, this is going to be a lot harder than we thought. We're asking our citizens, our governments, our economies to undertake some pretty significant changes to reduce emissions by certain levels, to bring about a reduction overall of greenhouse gas emissions. So this was going to be very difficult. And we saw that there were some parts of the world who were more ambitious, particularly in the countries of Western Europe. And then countries led by the United States. And of course, I shouldn't leave out the OPEC nations, although they're in a slightly different category because they were classed as developing countries. So there were different expectations that emerged around who would be reducing their emissions. And this, we can see the precursor, I suppose, for this line of thought by going back to the Stockholm conference, that there would be certain responsibilities that developed countries would undertake because they had had the privilege to industrialize first and to achieve greater wealth, and that then at some later point, developing countries, once they had achieved some degree of development, they too might then be expected to contribute. But as the negotiations unfolded and politics in the United States took a turn that was rather unfavourable towards signing an agreement that would allow the Clinton administration to sign up to any agreement that would affect the US economy, it meant that the Kyoto Protocol would have to take a rather different shape. It would have to, because I should add, the one of the caveats of these politics emerging in the United States was the Byrd-Hagel resolution. And this was not only concerned with ensuring that the US didn't sign a agreement that would affect its economy, that it would not sign an agreement that didn't have the involvement or assent of developing countries. So this was a really big problem, really, for achieving the kind of overall emissions reductions that they had hoped to achieve. Because at this time, the US is one of the biggest emitters, and they definitely needed to be within the tent and reducing their emissions. So there was a lot of compromise involved to ensure that the US would sign on and would be involved. And as we know, the Bush administration would eventually not sign up to the Kyoto Protocol. But nevertheless, the United States shaped the key mechanisms of the protocol around market mechanisms. And this is probably not all that surprising. This is really the heyday what's called liberal environmentalism, this kind of idea that after the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s, that, well, obviously market economies were more effective, stronger, and so on. They had been shown to be better in all ways after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So why not apply these same mechanisms to ensure that greenhouse gas emissions could be reduced? Now, one of the key mechanisms that emerges, and it's crafted between the United States and Brazil, surprisingly, is to develop what was the Clean Development Mechanism, a means for developing countries, even if they weren't reducing their own emissions, to be incorporated into an international market system of basically offsetting greenhouse gas emissions in the developed countries by turning to supporting sustainable development programs in the South. So that was one of the key mechanisms that emerged that had a lot of critique, and I think still would have a lot of concerns about, well, this is really a way for developed countries perhaps to avoid their responsibilities, that avoid being accountable. And what's also important to note was some of the interesting accounting that was employed to work out how emission reductions would be achieved. Every country had their own particular emission reduction that they were expected to achieve. So I've just looked at my notes here. The US was supposed to reduce theirs by 7% from 1990 levels, Canada 6%. These numbers were a little bit arbitrary. It wasn't entirely clear how they were arrived at. And my own country, Australia, was perhaps one of the more curious cases. Australia was actually allowed to emit more emissions relative to 1990 because of their, perhaps clever negotiators, if we want to be generous, but also because of the desire for consensus agreement to be reached. There was compromise to try and ensure that all countries would sign up to this agreement. Now, at the end of the day, we see that, of course, the US doesn't sign up to the Kyoto Protocol, despite playing such a fundamental role in shaping its design. And Australia follows the United States by not signing the Kyoto Protocol for some time, not until 2007, actually. But because of this need to have a certain percentage of emissions being covered by the Kyoto Protocol before that can come into action, although it's signed in 1997, it doesn't come into force until 2005, which, you know, that's quite a significant delay, and really points to some of the difficulties of trying to reach these kinds of agreements. And in the meantime, we have countries like China undergoing enormous growth and entering the World Trade Organization's. And yet China is not included in the list of countries, the developed countries, that are expected to reduce their emissions. So this is where it's a bit of a strange arrangement, because that list of countries that are the ones that are expected to reduce their emissions, that's based on their, I suppose, socioeconomic circumstances as of 1992. There's a lot that changes between 1992 and 2005 when the Kyoto Protocol actually comes into force.
And I think that's a very good summary of why it had so much criticism at the time and why it still continues to be seen as a missed opportunity, I suppose, is the most optimistic way to put it.
Yes, I think that's a good term for it. I'm not really sure how... Obviously, you know, as a historian, we're not very good at counterfactuals or the what if something had turned out differently. Certainly, they were in a very difficult position, not only with the domestic politics in the United States, but also with the developing countries grouped together as the Group of 77 plus China, that they were very adamant that, the bigger developing countries were adamant that they were not, they had not been responsible for these emissions and they should not have to curb their development. The only developing countries that were pushing for much more ambitious outcomes or a more ambitious protocol were, and we shouldn't be surprised, were the small island developing states, countries mm-hmm. in the Pacific, countries in the Indian Ocean and the Caribbean, who really understood from the outset that this was an existential problem for them, and they have been basically at the forefront of climate negotiations, trying to drag other countries with them from basically a very moral perspective, that time and time again standing up and saying this if these emissions are allowed to continue, this could mean the death of our nation. And they mm-hmm. return to this very confronting and emotional framing, because that is how that's the stakes for their countries. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's very much continuing today. And there's cases at the international court level on this topic as well that are underway sort of as we speak. So I suppose that kind of gives me a good platform to ask kind of what you're telling us about 2005 and sort of where we're at then. What sorts of alliances or kind of different countries and different groups or different actors and different groups, to what extent is that still kind of the same today as it was 20 years ago? Obviously, the small island aspect of it is very, there's a lot of continuity there. But is there anything that's sort of shifted since then that you think is particularly significant?
Well, I think it's really the shifts that we've seen in the lead up to the Copenhagen conference, which admittedly was not the crowning moment that many hoped it might be, but then further towards the lead up to Paris and what was seen as, well, I think mixed feelings. I suppose that the proof will be in the pudding there. But the changing circumstances for countries like China and India became very apparent, particularly at Copenhagen, where it's Brazil, the BRICS nations, in centre stage, really, with the negotiation of a very unusual agreement at Copenhagen. We had China, India, Brazil, and the United States, South Africa, involved in trying to work out what a new agreement would look like, what the successor to the Kyoto Protocol would look like. And that was quite remarkable. And what was interesting to explore a little further was how China and India, again, demonstrating how climate politics is not somehow separate from the rest of the world, that they very much are understanding the climate regime as part of their broader geopolitical ambitions and their broader development ambitions. So taking China, for example, the concerns at the government level about the implications for their legitimacy arising from terrible air pollution in Chinese cities, arising from rapid industrialization, they see very clearly the need to change their reliance on polluting sources of energy and needing renewable sources of energy to sustain their development and to sustain their hold on power. And the Clean Development Mechanism that I mentioned earlier as one of these Kyoto instruments was really important for China to actually gain access to that technology that they needed to start to transition away from coal and these dirtier technologies. They needed that access, and they wouldn't have perhaps been able to access it as quickly and as affordably as they were able to do through this Kyoto mechanism. India has been really keen to show its international leadership. They are very keen to have a seat at the Security Council, very keen to be a global leader. And so climate policy has been an important way for Indian governments to demonstrate that they are a legitimate player, and they've been heavily investing in solar technology as well, again through this Clean Development Mechanism, which has enabled them to adopt these kinds of technologies. Now, it's not to say that India and China are suddenly going to slash their emissions enormously, but when you look at the scale of development underway in these places, the size of the populations, and so on, these do represent very significant changes, I guess, to the kinds of stalling and really difficult negotiations that were underway in the 1990s, particularly around the Kyoto Protocol. So their role changed quite significantly. What's also been interesting has been the US, and yes, it's waxed and waned with the Trump administration, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But the US has pushed with the Pacific Islands and Europe under a high ambition coalition to try and get this what came out to be the Paris Agreement, the 2 degrees and ideally the 1.5 degrees of limiting dangerous climate change. So that was another sort of interesting reconfiguration of alliances. And of course, I'm not so naive to say that the US, is somehow pure of heart and not without its issues with its approach to climate change, but it certainly in the negotiations played a key role in bringing different these different countries together, and Europe too has remained very much on the side of the more ambitious targets throughout. So I think that's been quite interesting. And then we see, of course, the OPEC nations still I suppose, holding their ground, seeing that, of course, these negotiations are a real threat to their economies and trying, of course, to make sure that, either water down the commitments or to ensure that they have some kind of, trade-off that will lessen the impact on their own economies.
Given where we started off talking about optimism after atomic bombs being really not something we necessarily expect, you've brought us all the way up to the present, and it now sounds very familiar, but with understanding of how we actually got here, which is incredibly helpful. So I think very usefully now, listeners can kind of, next time there is one of these big COPs, look ahead and understand kind of who's allied with whom and who's trying to do what and why and how we ended up in this place. So I guess that leaves me only to ask, obviously I'm not going to ask you, like, what is the future of climate negotiations? Because I don't think anyone can answer that.
Now
at least we know what to look for, so that's helpful. But hopefully a question you can answer, what are you working on now that this book is done and out there?
Well, I wait with bated breath to see how this book is received. And of course, we could always think of things that we should have included, if only we could. But what I suppose I'm interested in developing in terms of a new project brings some of the themes of this book together with some of my ongoing interests in climate and water histories in Australia. And I'm very interested in exploring what was a post-Second World War program called the UNESCO Arid Zone Program. And I have come to realize that Australian scientists played a outsized role in this program's development and implementation, and saw them making quite a few interventions in Egypt and India and various arid parts of the world. And I'm curious to see, well, what does that mean for what is being transferred in terms of science, technology and ideas about development to places outside Australia? And what are those scientists bringing back? So there's all sorts of interesting political and environmental exchanges that I'm keen to explore there. So I'm keeping that international lens and but hoping to perhaps narrow my focus somewhat to see what is happening on the ground and how are some of these programs being resisted? Because that was certainly hard to get down to the local level in this sort of bigger history of climate change.
Yeah, no, I can absolutely understand that. But this new project sounds fascinating. So hopefully it becomes a book and we can have you back. But in the meantime, of course, listeners can read it. It's titled Climate Change and International History, Negotiating Science, Global Change and Environmental Justice, and just out in early 2024 from Bloomsbury. Ruth, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda. I've really enjoyed myself. Thank you.